The Commentary Track, conversations with film historians and filmmakers. With Frank Thompson.
Aloha, welcome to episode 69 of The Commentary Track. I'm your grass skirt clad host, Frank Thompson, and tonight we've got the islands on our mind. Film historian and author Luis Reyes is on the show, and we're going to talk about movies made in Hawaii and tropical island movies in general, and also the path of Hispanic actors and actresses in the history of Hollywood, all of which he has written books on. I've known Luis for a long time, and he's a swell guy. I really enjoy spending time with him and always enjoy talking with him. And this podcast was a great excuse for us to sit down for an hour plus and just talk. It's another one of those situations where afterwards we went out to lunch with my wife, Claire, and we just sat and talked for another hour there. We should have just kept the microphone with us, but you would have had us chewing hot dogs and stuff. And nah, that's not going to be pleasant to listen to. I wanted to alert you, those of you who live in the Los Angeles area or can get here in a timely fashion, about an upcoming program at the Academy. I have no dog in this hunt. I am not involved with this in any way, except I'm real excited about it. Craig Barron and Ben Burt, both of whom have been on the Commentary Track podcast, do these wonderful presentations about movies, and Ben will talk about the sound in these movies, and Craig will talk about the production values, and they will unearth, as a general rule, incredibly rare footage and stills and give you facts that you did not know. And they've done this. I've seen programs on King Kong and on Gunga Din and on many other great movies, and it's always terrific. And they have a series coming up starting this week at the Academy. It's at the Linwood Dunn Theater of the Academy in Hollywood, which is on Vine Street. On Thursday night, August 14th, their program is The Illusions of Flight, Behind the Scenes of Hollywood's Aviation Classics. And I was lucky enough to be with Craig and Ben when they were screening a few of these films. We actually watched a beautiful print of William A. Wellman's Young Eagles, which I had not seen in years, and had certainly never seen in 35mm. It's been a great deal of fun for me just to peripherally hang on to this project and to bug them on a regular basis on how's it going? Hey, what's going on? When are you going to finish? When is it going to show it? Well, they're going to show it this Thursday. That's when. So if you live in the area, I hope that you will go. Now, in the next three nights, Friday, August 15th, Saturday, August 16th, Sunday, August 17th, in case you were unclear on what the next three nights meant, they're going to show three more films and give great presentations beforehand. The first one I'm real excited about is Lilac Time, the 1928 film with Gary Cooper and Colleen Moore. It'll have musical accompaniment by the great John Marsalis. And then on Saturday night, it's 12 o'clock high, Henry King classic. And then on Sunday night, The Right Stuff, which I have not seen theatrically since it was brand new in 1983. And so I'm looking forward to that one as well. This is going to be a great series. As I say, I got no part of this. I'm not in it in any way. I just think it's really going to be a great series of programs. And Ben Burt and Craig Barron always deliver something astonishing. And this is going to be no exception. Also coming up is CineCon, which I'm always excited about because it's a film festival which consists mostly of stuff that is so rare that not only have I never seen it, but in many cases, I've never even heard of the films being shown. And that is so interesting and exciting to me. And it's always fun. And it's got a great dealer's room. And this year, Don Moore and I are doing a program in the hotel on Saturday. I believe it's at 12-ish, let's say. And it's over there where the dealer's rooms are. We're going to do a program celebrating the 100th birthday of her father, Clayton Moore. I helped Clayton write his autobiography, I Was That Masked Man, and Dawn helped him with everything. She was a loving daughter, and she knows all about her old man. And we got a couple of other guests coming up who, until they are definitely on the board, I don't want to mention, but assuming they show up, going to be some pretty cool stuff. So I hope you will come to see us there and say hello. And if you can come to CineCon, if you really love movies, and especially silent films and early sound films, there's no other place like it. They show them in 35mm at the Egyptian Theater. If it's a silent film, they always have musical accompaniment by terrific, usually pianist, but sometimes they'll bring in a little combo or a little orchestra or something. The Mont Alto Orchestra has played there with Beau Geste, the 26th film. And so, of course, that was a huge major night in my life. And so I'm just plugging that away, too. In this case, because I am doing a program, I do have a dog in this hunt. So, but for the rest of it, I don't. I just like it. The people who run it are really knowledgeable film buffs, and they find great stuff that's many times that the archives have just restored, and so we're getting to see really primo prints of a lot of good stuff. So I hope that you will join us there. And as I say, come up and say hello, and I'd be delighted to talk to you if, you know, unless you're just somebody I already know, and then I'm tired of you. Hey, come on. How much time can you take up of mine? I'm a busy guy. Nah, even if you know me, come say hello. And buy me lunch. So let's have a talk with Luis Reyes, and I'll see you on the other side. Years ago, you and I found ourselves at the same screening. We were seeing The Robin Hood of El Dorado at the Gene Autry Museum. Do you remember that?
Yes, absolutely.
And when we turned around, because you were sitting right behind us.
Correct.
And we were kind of talking with you a little bit before the movie started, but just kind of looking back over our shoulder. Then after the movie, we get up, say hello, and you're with Jimmy Smits.
Correct, yes.
So I've always wondered, was he just interested in that movie, or was he was somebody going to cast him as Joaquin Murrieta or something? Or
no, what happened was I had invited him to come see the film. We're friends. We've worked together on several projects, several films, The Cisco Kid, to name one of them, Mi Familia. So he knows I'm a movie nut, and I told him about this movie, and maybe he had some interest in maybe seeing what this Joaquin Murrieta thing was all about. And I told him this was the only film that I knew of except for the Jeffrey Hunter film, which was more like in the cheapo, spaghetti western, you know, European thing. And so he said, let's go see it. And it's at the Autry. And I invited him in, you know, again, gorgeous movie, very well done, very sensitive to, you know, the origins of the story. You know, so it was, that's why he was there, because I had invited him. And,
It was, it was cool to meet him. But,
and I know you're William Wellman, and it's not a film, it's not a film that's screened very often,
no.
if not at all, you know.
No, it shows up on TCM now and then. But I think it's terrific, and there's a lot of really good in it. But it really does, that movie ties in with your first book on Hispanics in Hollywood, because it is a prime example of being basically a Hispanic story in which there are almost no Hispanic actors in the
Except for Margot.
Except for Margot, yeah. But beyond that, it was Warner Baxter, who Wellman didn't want in the film, but instead he wanted Robert Taylor, who was even more Hispanic, I guess. So I like your book on Hispanics in Hollywood, and I think it's an important work. And I've always thought of the ethnic groups, minority groups in Hollywood, Hispanics have actually done better than most in terms of getting a mixture of some kind of stereotypical bandito kind of we don't need no stinking badges kind of roles. But there are a lot of Hispanic movie stars who are playing lead roles in movies, even in the 30s and 40s.
I don't know if it's a better time. I don't know. I wouldn't categorize it that way. I would just say that they fit into the mold of what Hollywood was doing at a particular point in time. First of all, the reason they came to Hollywood, I mean, the reason the film people came to Hollywood, besides the locations and the outdoor, you know, the great weather, which was necessary at that time, as you well know, in order for filming purposes. You needed that daylight. But also you had an available labor pool. And at that time, mostly were Mexican Americans, okay? And they were able to draw from that labor pool and utilize Mexicans or Mexican Americans to build sets as extras, okay? You know, you was it Raoul Walsh said you just put an Arab clothes on a Mexican, and he could play in the Thief of Baghdad, sure. You know, no problem. Plus, a genre that you're very familiar with is the Western. Okay, that was the staple of the film industry at the beginning, and what was part of the in the Westerns, either had the bandito or the beautiful señorita,
sure,
or the Spanish California dons. So we were, or the vaqueros, okay? So, and then you had stories that took place on one side of the border or the other, or at that time, there was no line, dividing line between Arizona and Mexico. I mean, it was all the Old West or the mythology of it. So it enabled a lot of people to access work in the industry as extras, as supporting players. I mean, one of the first Latino players was Antonio Moreno.
Sure.
Okay. And then you had another girl who was a star at Warner Brothers. Her name was Myrtle Gonzalez. Okay. So, and this was in the early teens.
Yeah.
So, yes, they did have more access to certain roles than maybe other ethnic groups because of the look, the way they are. I mean, the best example is Gilbert Roland or Anthony Quinn, you know, mm-hmm. in terms of being able to play many different ethnicities.
Sure.
You know, kind of thing.
But those guys were actually movie stars. I mean,
yes, absolutely.
And so, yeah.
But they came through the ranks.
I mean,
Gilbert Roland was an extra.
Absolutely.
His family came here during the Mexican Revolution, okay, to escape Pancho Villa. Anthony Quinn as well, okay.
Yeah.
So, but they had that look that they could play different kinds of characters.
But that's my point, that we did have actual movie stars who were Hispanic.
Yes, absolutely.
When there were no movie stars who were black or Asian at that time, you know. They were still supporting people and didn't rise up into above the title.
Oh yeah, you had Dolores Del Rio,
sure.
You know Ramon Navarro, but we did have one Asian star, which was Anna May Wong, okay, and we did have another Asian star, Seshu Hayakawa.
Yeah.
So they weren't entirely absent. African Americans was a totally different thing. Actually,
sure.
There a few stars did pop up, but it was in the late 30s. You know, like Cab Calloway, Lena Horne.
Yeah, they all came from music. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, very limited. But yes, there were. Oh, are the famous African American? He was a actor, activist.
Paul Robeson.
Yeah, Paul Robeson.
Yeah.
He did Showboat.
When you were first getting interested in movies, what were you watching just as a kid? What really caught your eye?
You and I were baby boomers,
mm-hmm.
So not to identify our age bracket, but that's close enough.
28.
Yeah. Right. Or 39, as Jack Benny would say, right? Yeah, I would watch, I was watching all the TV westerns, you know, Cheyenne, Hawaiian Eye, all the TV shows that were on, Cisco Kid,
sure.
The Lone Ranger. In movies, it was John Wayne, the 300 Spartans, Richard Egan, Ben-Hur, with Charlton Heston, all the old movies that came on TV. Remember, there was a thing called The Late Show, and they would show old movies, you know, so... got acquainted with Humphrey Bogart, James Cagney, all the great stars. You know, we were in that era. Then a little later on, it was the age of the revival houses, and you had that whole Bogart revival in the late 60s, that anti-hero thing.
Sure.
So
you were interested in all those, right?
Yeah, and I grew up in New York, so it was all accessible to me.
Yeah.
I didn't grow up in a small town. I grew up in New York City, so, I mean, I had the world at my feet in terms of movies and cinema and... You know, they shot a few movies in New York, got to meet a few actors, so Peter Falk, I got to meet Robert Ryan. I mean, he was just like anybody else. He'd go to the theater and buy theater tickets to go see a play, you know, when he was actually on his one night off from doing, he was doing the front page at that time in New York. So you got to see, you know, some of the actors in person because they lived in New York or, you know, they went there to do a film, but there wasn't as much filming done then as it is now, you know, so it was very limited.
When did you come out here?
I came out here to college in 72, got a scholarship to go to University of the Pacific, which is in Northern California in Stockton. And at that time, it was a college called Albert Covell College, and it was the only bilingual college in the United States, where half the student body was from Latin America and the other half was of Americans from the United States, as well as the teachers. The teachers were either from Latin America, half of them, and the other half, they were Americans, but they were diplomats, had been former diplomats, or they had businesses or had worked for corporations in Latin America. So it was a nice mix.
When did you start zeroing in on, well, first, your first book was on Hispanics in Hollywood. When did that start appealing to you as a subject?
Well, when I grew up in New York, I had heard about Nosotros, which was the organization that Ricardo Montalban had started to promote Latino talent and more positive roles. And I thought that was a good thing. That was during the activist 60s when, sure, you know, part of the Puerto Rican Young Lords and the Brown Berets out here, you know, to try the whole civil rights movement. And films did not reflect the reality of what we were living, okay? And when I got out here, I got to meet Ricardo Montalban. I got to meet Gilbert Rowland, all these people that I admired, Anthony Quinn. Then I found out about all the supporting players and what was happening here. And there was no book on Latinos in Hollywood. There were plenty of books on Latin American cinema, the cinema of Mexico, but there was nothing about the involvement of Latinos as part of the American film. Just like the Jewish American experience or the emigres, the people that came over from Europe to work here, it was all part of that melting pot that we call Hollywood, okay? And there was no information on that. So I was gathering information from people that had worked in the industry, mm-hmm, because it was at that point, that transition point, where these people were dying and their stories were dying with them. Like, I would come upon people and I say, oh yeah, my father worked with John Wayne. We had an album, but Auntie Sophie, you know, scounded with the pictures, and we never, you know, or as kids, we never take that much of an interest into what our parents do. Oh yeah, my dad works in the movie, but the details, sure, you know. So anyway, so I was able to interview a lot of people before they passed on, and I've got information about the beginnings of Latinos working here in the film industry in all different levels. So anyway, so that's how I began to document that history and the whole problem of it's almost like making a film, trying to get an agent to represent the book and then also try to get somebody to feel that it's a worthy subject matter. Oh, you're doing a book on Latinos in Hollywood? Oh, must be a very small book because nobody had done the research. Nobody knew. Okay. And then when I did the book, the publishers were going like, well, how do we know this is, you're not a PhD or some, you know. I said, no, I've lived this. I've talked to the people. Oh, but they had no experts in that field.
Yeah.
So there was nobody who knew whether what I was writing was real or not or true or not or whatever, because, you know, they had Latin American cinema experts, but they didn't know. So anyway, so got through all of that and got it published and did very well with it. And like I said, no one had done a book about Latinos in Hollywood and the history, and it wound up being a 600-page book, you know.
Yeah.
Okay, because no one had, you know. So what's happened since then is that I've tried to create a niche for myself in terms of doing ethnic subject matter or subject matter that no one else is doing. So I did the book with a co-author, Ed Rampell, on Made in Paradise, because no one had really documented the films that had been made in Hawaii.
Sure.
You know, and the Polynesian experience or the Melanesian, the whole experience of Hawaii in films. And there were a lot of Hawaii people in a lot of these films. So I've tried to create a niche with myself. And then I did Pearl Harbor in the movies, which was about all the movies of Pearl Harbor, which coincided with the 60th anniversary in 2001. And now we've done this follow-up book, which is the Hawaii movie and television book, which is about the major films and television shows that were made in Hawaii, celebrating the 100th anniversary of filmmaking in Hawaii.
Yeah, I was not aware of those early films that were made there in 1913. Do they exist?
No, they don't. Yeah. Unfortunately, they are lost. Okay, and but they were done. You know, there's stills survive.
Yeah.
Some photos, but that's about it. And some newspaper announcements on the film that are illustrated in the book. But no. But it's interesting that with Hawaiian Love and Shark God, which was a one-reeler, which in those days was a feature,
sure.
10 minutes long,
yeah.
The lady that starred in it, she was an actress, a stage actress that went into films, into silent films. She gave up her career because she married the director. And after she raised her kids, she went back into the business, and she was older, and she did lots of sound movies, and she did Captain from Castile. She played Antonio Moreno's wife, and I guess she's best known today, if she's known at all, for playing James Dean's grandmother in Rebel Without a Cause.
Yeah.
Virginia Bresic. Yeah.
Now, how did it come that those movies were made? Because I'm interested in, because that was a trip for a Hollywood crew.
Correct.
So they must have had a real good reason to do that.
Well, they were very, first of all, they did it, they didn't need much equipment in those days. It was
sure.
silent. So that was easy. They had ocean liners, the Matson line, that would take you to Hawaii in 5 days, 6 days. And they were a theater troupe. And so they did shows in Hawaii, in the theaters in Hawaii, while they did the movies. So they made some kind of, they made an income of performing on stage while they shot these short movies when they weren't performing at night.
Interesting.
Yeah.
You know, the Melies Star Film Company, I wrote a book about what they did in San Antonio, but after they left, they came to California for a while, and then they decided to make a round-the-world voyage and make movies at every stop, which they did, and which everybody hated. But the first one they made exists, and it's called Mr. and Mrs. Mott Go to Tahiti. And and half the movie takes place on the boat, and then half the movie takes place once they get to Tahiti. And it's fascinating because it's actually in Tahiti. And that's 1912.
Oh, yes.
So, so people were starting to do that kind of stuff. But it really seems like you have to have a good reason to do it. They thought, I mean, it's in theory, it sounded great. You could just go all around the world, go to all these exotic places, and your movies are going to be great, right?
Whether they were great or not, it didn't matter, because remember,
sure,
it was the dawn of film in theaters, and people had looked at anything. I mean, it's hard for us to imagine that now with cable and 1,000 channels that we have and everything. Saturated with, these images from all over, digital images, everything like that. But in those days, it was new.
Yeah.
So, I mean, one of the first films, it wasn't feature, but it was a short subjects, really like a travelogue, was Kanaka's Diving for Coin that the Edison Company did, which was a similar thing. They did it maybe 10 years earlier. Just kids diving off the pier in Hawaii into the water,
Yeah.
So, similar thing. So, yes, absolutely. And then later on, I mean, you had Clara Bow went to Hawaii. Again, you could put everything on a ship and go to Hawaii and film what you needed there.
Sure.
And come back. And Clara Bow did Hula on location there.
Yeah.
And that was the It Girl. Okay. And then later on in, 31, again, Fox, not 20th Century Fox, was still Fox Film Studios with the Charlie Chan. They did one of the first Charlie Chan films, and the only one that was actually shot in Hawaii, where the stories originally took place, because even though he's a Chinese detective, Charlie Chan is from Honolulu.
Sure.
With the Honolulu Police Department, okay? And they packed everything on a motion liner, sound equipment, everything, and went to Hawaii and shot most of the film on the beach in front of the Royal Hawaiian Hotel, and
wow.
In and around the Royal Hawaiian Hotel. So it was practical at that time to do.
Yeah, that's one I've never seen. I've seen most of the Charlie Chans, but I haven't seen that one, and now I really want to, because I was reading about it in your book, and I thought, wow, it must be beautiful to look at, if nothing else.
It's, oh, it is. I mean, yeah. You can tell it was shot on location, and black and white,
sure.
But it was shot on location, and it has a few treats, because the future, well, actually, he was already Dracula. Bela Lugosi's in it, and... Warner Olin, who played Charlie Chan, he was starting to define his character in a much stronger way now. So it's a fun movie, and it's very well done, and you can appreciate the locations. And Royal Hawaiian's still there, you know, and you can still see some of the locations are still there.
Now, in the 20s and the 30s, it seems to me that primarily when you're going to do a tropical film, you'd go to Catalina.
Well, yes.
And then... So it was. It seemed to me that it must be a special occasion when they would decide to make the extra trip, because Catalina, even in those days, you could get there less than a day. I mean, just with the from Hollywood, so it's not that big a deal. But going to Hawaii was. It was still just an investment in time, if nothing else.
Oh, correct.
Just to get there, because the voyage itself must have taken a few days.
5 days.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. No. Absolutely. You're absolutely right, but yeah, for the most part, and that was an exception, and that was towards the end of the Fox reign before it became 20th Century Fox. I mean, that's when they also did, as you well know, the Big Trail.
Sure.
So they kind of invested in doing certain kinds of films and going on location. And again, it was kind of interesting because it was also the time of the transition
yeah.
from silent to sound. And to go on location with sound equipment at that time also was, you know, so kind of... destroys the myth that all of the films were done in the studio.
Oh, sure.
You know, and that the camera was
yeah.
static. If you see.
It's not true
movie,
at all. No.
Yeah, the,
no.
the camera moves all over the place.
Yeah.
And it's very scenic, and you can tell you're in Hawaii. I mean, there's no doubt about it.
Yeah, that's a myth that's hard to kill.
Yes.
The whole microphone in the flower pot stories.
Exactly.
But
I'll tell you one thing, you're absolutely right. For the most part, that was rare. Most of the films during the 30s were done on the soundstage. Mutiny on the Bounty with Clark Gable, that was done in Catalina.
Okay? Yeah.
There was some travelogue that they used in the for background footage that they shot. I think they took from Flaherty's was it White
Taboo?
Shadow?
Oh, White Shadow.
Robert
South
Flaherty,
yeah.
Robert Flaherty was a document, sort of like a documentarian. So they used some of that background footage, but they shot most of it at the back lot at MGM or at Catalina. The Hurricane with John Ford, with Dorothy L'Amour, that was shot at the Goldwyn Studios. They
yeah.
had a, they built a like kind of a lagoon and the palm trees and yeah. So for the most part, again, then they filled it in with you know background stock footage. Yes,
but in those days, especially the silent era. The great majority of people didn't travel that far from their homes in the world. I mean, it's only rare people got to go, say, to Europe or to Asia from America. It wasn't travel like it is today.
Correct.
And so the movies, there was a lot to do with just what they could show you. They could show you the world. And I think that's why it made it worthwhile to go to Hawaii or go to some other islands. Just to show the world these images that they would probably never get to see on their own, and it was like the world opening up to them. In the days before television, this was the way to see the world without actually getting on a boat.
Oh, absolutely! And for Hawaii in particular, Hawaii was again 5 days journey by boat. At the same time that Hawaii was gaining in stature in terms of the popular culture, we had Hawaiian music was starting to hit. Hawaiian performers performed at the 1913, it wasn't a World's Fair, but it was like a World's Fair in San Francisco.
Like the Exposition.
The Exposition. Yeah, yeah. You know, Hawaiian music was starting to hit Tin Pan Alley on Broadway, or semi,
sure.
You know. So it started... kind of permeating the culture, and then why at that time also Hollywood was building up. You had a new aristocracy, new money. Okay, Charlie Chaplin and all these people, they started going to Hawaii on vacation. Okay, it was the province of the rich, as you're absolutely right, the rich and famous only went to Hawaii. It wasn't like today. You had to have big bucks to go to Hawaii,
sure.
You know, unless you were in the military. And then in the military, Hawaii was like, they were sending you to the ends of the earth. It was,
yeah.
It wasn't the ideal that it is today. You know, it was like, you're going to Hawaii, mosquitoes, it's hot, it's drama, you know, kind of thing. So it wasn't quite the ideal destination. But for the tourists and the well-heeled tourists, I mean, people, it sounds funny, I would say they bring their film equipment, but people would bring with them their cars, their servants. I mean, the
sure.
whole, they literally, and they move into these bungalows by the beach. And that's what prompted the entrepreneurs that were part of the Matson line to start building the Royal Hawaiian Hotel and places that were upscale, where people could stay and get all the services that they wanted and that kind of thing. So it became, that's one reason Hollywood went there. It was like, okay, we'll go make a movie and we can go on vacation, you know, at the same time.
What was the first big feature? Would it be Bird of Paradise? The first real major motion picture
in
made
the sound
in
era.
Yeah.
In the sound era, I'd say it was Bird of Paradise, the original version with Dolores Del Rio.
Yeah.
Okay, and the young Joel
McRae. Yeah.
And
that's a beautiful looking picture too.
That really shows off the locations. Anyway. But King Vidor had a tough time over there because the weather didn't cooperate as well as he had hoped. So after like 3 weeks, he decided to come back to California and finish the picture here on Catalina.
Sure.
and the back lot. But the stuff that he did shoot in Hawaii, you can see is clearly Hawaii. Absolutely.
Yeah. What do you think the real, besides the background, I've always figured that one of the appeals of Hawaiian films and tropical island films is because in a day when you didn't get to see a lot of scantily clad ladies in movies, the women in the grass skirts and everything must have been a big appeal, right?
Oh, absolutely. When we can get into this a little bit about the South Sea cinema genre. But South Sea cinema without sex is like co-author says is like South Sea cinema without sex is like Aunt Jemima pancakes without the syrup. You know, you can't have one without the other.
Well, sure. Right?
So, yes, what happened is what we began, me and my co-author, and also the South Sea Cinema Society that is based in Hawaii, which is a bunch of fans that love South Sea cinema that have become also more of a historical kind of track. But South Sea cinema is basically is cinema that takes place in or around the South Seas. And it's a genre that's just been recently recognized because what happens is that it usually gets thrown in with the swashbuckler or the sea movies. And it really is a genre all of its own. And one of the things is paradise, which is you don't see in many movies.
Sure.
It's a utopian society. And part of that is, and usually it's the natives mingling with the outside world. And also it's the outside world's impact on the natives.
Always a negative impact.
A negative impact. Because you have this idyllic society and you bring in elements from the outside that threatens to destroy that society. And that's one of the things things that are essential to South Sea cinema. And those are some of the things that involve the idea of what South Sea cinema is like. And the native girl, a beautiful native girl who was very sexual, was very available sexually, was very free, is also part of that male fantasy. And all of that comes from the literature of Robert Louis Stevenson, from the early sailors that explorers that traveled through the South Seas. I mean, if you've been on a ship for 6 months, any girl's going to look good to you. You know, I mean, that's the truth. I mean, but they had this idealized version of the island girl that's still used today in advertisements, you know.
I've always wondered what degree of truth there was in that, because certainly at the time, I mean, even in Mutiny on the Bounty, the world that those sailors came from was in many ways a very rigid, buttoned up world. And so it's unclear to me whether the natives they met in Tahiti and around there were actually as free living as they saw them to be, or if just by comparison to what they were used to, that it just seemed like, you know, these women were wearing basically no clothes, and so it must have just seemed, wow, paradise of a separate level there.
Oh yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Because again, remember, you hit it on the nail. You're talking about people who come from a rigid, 15th, 16th century society. Uneducated, usually poor, some were educated, and you've been on a boat for 6 months with no female company at all. You get to an island, and then there was also, they weren't always free living, they weren't an industrious people in the sense of the way Victorian society saw it. But these people did fish, they did hunt, they were agricultural. I mean, Hawaii had a king and a kingdom, society before, the English.
Yeah.
And then also they had the idea that the white skin, there was something special about it. So there was something special about getting together with someone of white skin. They thought, some of the islanders thought that it was, something special.
Yeah.
Okay. So all of those factors brought in, and then also the religious factor. Again, the Victorian or Anglo-Saxon Protestant way of looking at things as opposed to the islanders. So you had a certain amount. But then all the natives weren't friendly. Captain Cook was killed.
Sure.
Okay. So that's a fallacy that you see a lot in the South Seas movies. That's one of the... things that you see is in Mutiny on the Bounty and all the versions, and it's even in Bird of Paradise, friendly natives to greet you. All come out, oh, the ship, and they all, they blow the horn, the conch horn, and they all come out in their canoes and greet the travelers.
They couldn't be more delighted to meet the British guys.
Exactly.
And
especially if they're Marlon Brando, Clark Gable.
Well, yeah.
Right? Or Joel McRae. Okay.
Yeah, the great irony is that in so many of those island films from the 30s through the 60s, they actually had to dress up the women in more clothing than they normally would have been wearing in real life. I don't think a bounty movie, until you get to the Mel Gibson, Anthony Hopkins version, do you see women just walking around just bare-breasted and with their little skirts on and things. And that seems to be, I mean, all I'm basing it on, I remember when I was a kid, I had the Bounty trilogy, and it had Wyeth illustrations. And one of the reasons I liked it so much at the age of 8 or 9 was that several of the illustrations had pictures of women bare-breasted. And that was okay by me at that age, at this age too, but at that,
but no, absolutely.
But I did grow up thinking that must be an accurate depiction of what island life was like, and I don't know if it really was.
Well, in Tahiti, yes, I mean, to a certain extent, actually, and Hawaii to a certain extent. But then when the Christian missionaries came in, they messed everything up. They put women in muumuus and long dresses that covered them up. Movies couldn't always show that, but if you look closely at the Brando version, women are topless.
Yeah.
Again.
Yeah, they're wearing leis and things like.
But they are
sure.
Topless, and even Dolores Del Rio, to a certain extent, but she had them really pasted because she moved around, and those leis never moved from But
it was 32, so yeah. It was still pre-code.
Yeah, but she had a nude scene underneath the underneath the waterfall. Okay, that you can see. Pretty clear that she doesn't have any clothes on. But also we had a double standard, too, is that in those movies, is that the real natives could be shown nude. we had a double standard of race.
Yeah.
Okay, this is where racism comes. It's okay to show a brown breast, but you can't show a white breast.
Yeah.
Okay. So you had a lot of films that did show natives, be they of islanders or of from Africa or other countries, bare-breasted, as long as they weren't white.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, it was okay. You know, but you wouldn't see the lead actresses in that. You know.
Yeah, I remember the first time I saw a restored print of Tarzan and His Mate, which, of course, does have a nude swimming scene with a double for Maureen O'Sullivan. But in the opening sequences, when the camera's just tracking through the village, all the women are bare-breasted, all the native women. And I thought at the time, the first time I saw it, that was an odd thing, because they're certainly the native women were lovely to look at. So, but somehow, it didn't seem like, I don't know what it was. It's just a weird double standard that they would use in Hollywood. It doesn't make any sense.
It does, in terms of the racism and the double standard that existed in the 1930s and 40s and 50s.
Do you think they just looked at these people as less than human?
Yes.
So it didn't.
Yes, I mean they're black, they're brown. It's that's the way it was. I mean, you could get away with it, and it was fine. But you wouldn't see Dorothy L'Amour topless.
No.
Okay. You know.
Darn it.
Yeah.
What are your favorite movies of that genre? Which are the big ones to you?
Well, the big one is, I'd say, Bird of Paradise, of the South Seas genre, because now we'll get into the bigger picture.
Sure.
Which is why I'd say Bird of Paradise, the first one with Dolores Del Rio, and I love the second one, the Technicolor version, 1950, with Deborah Padgett, mm-hmm. Louis Jourdan, and my favorite guy, Jeff Chandler.
Yep.
Okay.
Nobody remembers Jeff Chandler.
Oh,
anymore.
But he was
That's
great.
So sad. Yeah.
I mean, he was rugged. He could play different ethnicities. He won an Academy Award nomination for playing Goat Cheese in Broken Arrow. Sturdy, leading man. One of the films I saw as a kid, Merrill's Marauders.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, yeah. Sure.
Okay. So, I do love the second version as well. The Mutiny on the Bounty with Marlon Brando is a gorgeous film. I mean,
seeing
on the big screen, it just sweeps you away. And it was shot totally in Tahiti. Beautiful film.
Sure it is, yeah.
Just gorgeous to watch.
Yeah.
And it's just
I'd love to see a 70mm print of that. I saw it in original release, and then that's the last time I saw a 70mm print.
Oh, I have it on DVD, but I'd love to see it in theater on a big screen again. That would be quite something to see.
Sure. Are you listening, Egyptian?
Yes, please. But I think that's one of the most important ones. I guess those are my favorite in the South Seas genre. All of the Dorothy L'Amour films that I've gotten to see recently. I might have seen them when I was a kid, but I just recently saw them. They've shown them at the Egyptian here in Los Angeles, mm-hmm. actually, and in a couple of weeks they're showing the first one that I've never seen, The Jungle Princess. Showing it at UCLA. So I'm looking forward to see that. And a lot of those were done in three-strip Technicolor, so they really come blazing at you, popping out of the screen. So I would say those are my favorite of that genre. Oh, and the one that I grew up with was Donovan's Reef.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, with John Wayne. Again, shot on location on Kauai.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a gorgeous film to look at, and it's fun. It doesn't try to be anything but a fun, entertaining movie. And again, it has respect for the culture and the people.
Yeah. It has a little bit of a point of view, too. I mean, it's a movie.
It deals with racism.
It's a movie that's about something,
It deals with the racism where, they're afraid. The same things of the genre. This upper-class Boston family and the Doc, which is played by Jack Warden, who's kind of forsaken that kind of life for mm-hmm. the island life after having experienced World War II. You know, and he stays there, and he marries a native woman, and his daughter that he left behind in the States comes to visit her father, and John Wayne and his buddies are trying to protect him from the attitudes of the Boston, of miscegenation.
Sure.
Which also kind of deals a little bit, falls into the South Pacific, the movie South sure. Pacific, which is another favorite, which also deals with someone from Little Rock, Arkansas, and the whole experience of World War II and having to deal with people who are different. And
yeah, that's South Pacific is one that, I mean, it's mostly about racism, it's mostly about, and interesting that it has a leading character who, in Mitzi Gaynor, or Nellie Forbush, the character, who just right away her reaction to the fact that this man she's interested in has kids who are part Polynesian and part American or part white or whatever he is, French, I guess. And she's horrified. She's just horrified by it. And it's, you think, wow, that's actually, they were being pretty honest about those kind of issues right off the bat in a movie that seems like just kind of a South Sea fantasy in some ways, but it's really hard hitting on those terms.
Oh, absolutely. And also remember, it was a play.
Yeah, of course.
And the play dealt with the same issues in 49. So this was just right after the war.
Yeah.
So, and that play was so popular, you know, the songs You Have to Be Carefully Taught, you know.
Yeah.
The romance of Bali High calls you onward. So it was ahead of its time. And then even pre-Vietnam War, the girl that Lieutenant Cable falls in love with actually is not Polynesian. She's Tonkinese.
Ah.
The Gulf of Tonkin. So, I mean, she's part Vietnamese.
Sure.
Okay, so, and the whole idea of South Pacific, it was soldiers being uprooted, American soldiers, and being put in a totally different situation that they'd ever been used to before. And that's what actually the movie South Pacific comes from, Tales of the South Pacific, which was written by James H. Michener, who fought in World War II and was in the South Pacific.
Yeah.
And that's what he recounted some of the stories of his experiences there.
When I was a little kid, there was a TV show called Adventures in Paradise.
Yes, with Gardner McKay.
Gardner McKay, based on the stories by James A. Michener.
Correct.
I just thought of that. I haven't seen it since I was a child, but where was that shot? That must have been just Catalina, right? Or was it?
Actually, it was a 20th Century Fox back lot, and it with stock footage.
I can just remember the opening sequence. He's on a catamaran.
Correct.
And I figured that just ocean is ocean, so I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it's right out here.
Yeah.
But going forward now, since we're talking about it, Adventures in Paradise, we also had another show, which was the first show that was shot partly in Hawaii, but mostly at Warner Brothers Studio, was Hawaii and I.
Yeah.
Which is now most famous for, it was the setting for Robert Conrad.
Yeah.
Okay, who starred in the show along with Connie Stevens and Anthony Isley. But that was the first show that was set in Hawaii, and they did go for the first couple of episodes to Hawaii. But one of the actors on the show, his name was Doug Mossman, who's Polynesian, actually Hawaiian, from Hawaii. He played Moki, the security guard on the show. He was one of the first people hired on the show, and he did double duty as a consultant on the film, because most of the shows were shot on the back lot at Warner Brothers,
sure,
or in the location, nearby locations. But his job, he loved it. When he first got there, his job was to sit through hundreds of Warner Brothers films in a screening room and pull out any scene that had tropical images in it that could be utilized on the show. And so he went through hundreds of Warner Brothers films, travelogues, whatever, anything that had a sunset, that had palm trees, whatever, they pulled it out. And that was his first job.
Wow.
So that's what they did. They, for the convenience of a TV show, they shot it on the back lot. They would go to Hawaii at the beginning of the season, and maybe do an episode or do background footage, and then they would do the rest here.
Yeah, they'd probably shoot a lot of wild bee footage and or B-roll and just use it up as the season went on.
Yeah, exactly.
There's a big lagoon on the back lot at Warner Brothers. I think it's even still there, although civilization has been knocking all that stuff down for years. But I know they used it in Fantasy Island, this
correct.
Lagoon. And I wonder if it dates all the way back to Hawaii&I, if it would have been...
Yes, it does.
It probably
absolutely.
Does, I would think. Yeah,
it does, actually, before then, if you actually...
Yeah.
But one of the locations they did use here quite frequently, and we were jumping all over the place.
Sure.
But,
that's what
since
we
you
do.
Mentioned it, yeah, was the Arboretum, the LA
County
Arboretum. Actually, that was the original location for Fantasy Island.
Yeah.
Okay. The cottage and the lagoon there was where they shot Fantasy Island. And they did go to Hawaii and they'd shoot the waterfalls and all the background stuff. But the show was shot at the Arboretum. And that dates back to Tarzan movies.
Oh, yeah, way
the
back.
Arboretum.
Objective Burma.
Objective Burma. You can see the cottage there.
Sure.
You can see them jumping into the lagoon that's right there. So, and it was used in Marathon Man. It's been used in a lot of films.
Yeah, my wife and I have gone there several times.
It's
I love
beautiful
this
place.
Yeah, beautiful.
Oh, beautiful.
And quite a film history. Seems like Abbott and Costello, maybe Pardon My Sarong, something.
Probably.
I think part of that there, too. I guess Pardon My Sarong would be another tropical film that doesn't quite ever get tropical. It was probably all just the Universal backlot and the Arboretum.
I mean, everything was shot basically here until really after World War II. Okay, when they found the lighter film equipment, the faster film stocks, they didn't need as much support equipment, and also transportation. So it wouldn't take a 5-day trip on a boat. You could airlift everything.
Sure.
Because of the war, you know, they had to get the equipment and the supplies. Hawaii became the center of the war in the Pacific in terms of supplying all the different areas of combat. So it made it easier to get to far-off locations because of that. You
know? And I would think that little by little, they must have started setting up production facilities in Hawaii.
Actually,
because they must have been getting business regularly enough sooner or later that it would be worthwhile to just keep equipment over there.
Yeah, well, that really didn't start. Actually, most films that up until about 1968, most films would come to the island, shoot, like in harm's way.
Mm-hmm.
They would shoot, and they would take everything back with them. Hawaii, the film with Julie Andrews and Max von Sydow.
That was a big one.
That was a very, very big film. But again, they would go to the islands, establish everything in Honolulu, shoot the film, and take everything back with them. You know,
wow.
So it wasn't until 1968 with Hawaii 5-0 that production started to stay in the islands, and they needed the support services for a television show. And Hawaii 5-0 lasted 12 years, 12 seasons. So over that 12 years... production facilities began to be constructed. They had a sound stage that was built because originally they started shooting it in a warehouse, and then they built a stage, a small stage to use for the filming. And then slowly but surely, an industry started to develop in Hawaii. Since Hawaii 5-0 lasted 12 years. They hired a lot of crew members. It became a training program for the locals, and they accessed jobs in all areas behind the scenes, as well as in front of the camera, because Hawaii 5-0 hired a lot of locals in small bit parts. Some of them went on to leading roles. A few of them were cast right off the bat, like Cam Fong, who played Chin Ho Kelly, and quite a lot of Hawaiian performers were hired on the show. So that's where the basis of a film industry that exists now started with Hawaii 5-0. And then once Hawaii 5-0 ended its run, the people that were working on Hawaii 5-0 went right into the next big show that came along right after Hawaii 5-0, which was Magnum P.I. And Magnum P.I. with Tom Selleck, that lasted 8 years. So again, that gave people the experience and the ability to be able to become union members in the guilds, SAG, Teamsters, all of the industry began to be developed.
That's great. Yeah. Were both of those shows, Hawaii Five-O and Magnum P.I., filmed entirely on the island, or did they come back to do studio stuff too?
No, everything was, all the sets were built. If you ever go to Iolani Palace, to that corner office, that office is as big as this room that we're in. But on the TV show, that corner office is huge, okay? So, no, there were sets that were built at a small soundstage that is now the Hawaii Film Studio that now consists of two stages there. And then empty warehouses are converted for several productions if they need space or that kind of thing.
Production of Lost really showed off Hawaii to incredible detail, didn't it?
Yes, especially because what was important about Lost is that it not only showed off Hawaii, but because of the necessity of doing a show there, they were forced to find locations within the island that could pass for other places. So downtown Honolulu became New York for certain scenes, and also an airport in Australia. So it became it not only functioned as an island, it also functioned as different places. So they were able to really exploit what Honolulu has. Also, certain places became Japan because there are temples.
Sure.
And then Lost also lasted for quite a number of years. But by the time Lost came around, a lot of the people, it's the sons of people that started with Hawaii Five-O. Yeah.
I think Lost must have been on for six
seasons, correct.
Six seasons, yeah. So, and the new Hawaii Five-O, I guess, is entirely on location, right?
Correct. And it's going into its fifth season.
Yeah.
Okay. So again, that has helped quite a bit with the local economy, again, what a TV show does. But then this year, you also had Godzilla that filmed there. So you have lots of different commercials. Please not forget commercials. But the main, nothing can compare with what a TV show can bring, because you're talking about 22 episodes or 26, depending on the show, and all the jobs that it creates.
Yeah.
Not only immediately with the actors, but production, behind the scenes, catering. And also, it's the best commercial for Hawaii.
Sure.
Okay, because every week you see these beautiful islands and these people, and you want to go. And now, because of jet travel, as of 1959, the jumbo jets, you can get there fairly inexpensively as compared to the old days.
Well, sure.
Okay. So Hawaii is within the reach of most people now.
And it is. A B-movie director once said to me, nudity is the cheapest special effect. But in many ways, Hawaii is the cheapest special effect, too. Because you just point your camera at almost anything, and it's great. You know, it just looks beautiful there.
Yeah, it was just Jack Lord used to say that he was second banana to a palm tree.
Yeah. I think he probably was. But also, yeah, that show just had such beauty to it, despite whatever this plot was or whatever they were doing. It didn't matter, because right behind them was just this splendor.
Right, and it's funny because Hawaii is used for these crime shows, but actually Hawaii has the lowest crime rate in the United States. I mean, so it's interesting that that dichotomy exists. Also, I was going to speak about, also, Hawaii is used as other places. It's also used as Africa. It's also used for World War II jungle films, because the great thing about Hawaii is you can be in a jungle, and in 10 minutes after you're done filming for the day, you're at a beautiful, gorgeous hotel with all the amenities and everything that you need. That's one reason why Spielberg filmed Jurassic Park there on Kauai, is that he could be in this tropical place, in this tropical jungle, and get this, all these dinosaur effects and everything, and then at the end of the day, go back to a beautiful hotel, you know, and have all the amenities that he needed. If you go to Africa or other places, it's the amenities are not there. Plus, you're dealing with disease, you're dealing with malaria, you're dealing with also local currency. Also, in many countries, there's you don't have the support services that you need for a film, and also sometimes political instability. So for all those reasons, Hawaii can be, it's so much easier to go Hawaii. There was a film with The Rock, Dwayne The Rock Johnson, called The Rundown, supposed to take place in Brazil. They went to Brazil to location scout, and they got held up, okay? They got robbed. So they said, forget it, and they went and shot it in Hawaii, you know. So, you know, it can be different places. Like Indiana Jones, okay, the beginning, the first scene in Indiana Jones with the Indians.
Yeah.
Okay, that takes place in South America was shot on Kauai, okay? And so it can be many different places. And so, and also many different, and serve many different genres. And then, but one of the most important films that was shot in Hawaii is From Here to Eternity.
Yeah.
It's the most honored film in terms of Oscars and in terms of putting Hawaii on the map as a location, okay, because the film was so successful and also took, based on the novel that also took place there. Okay. So that was actually shot at Schofield Barracks. It was shot on Waikiki, and you can still go to Schofield Barracks today and still see the actual place where they actually filmed the film.
How many... That was a film that has the Pearl Harbor attack in it.
Correct.
And I guess the most recent one we have is Pearl Harbor itself, right?
Correct.
I mean, how many films have been about Pearl Harbor? Because I'm trying to count up. In Harm's Way.
My book, it was about 100 films, but they're not always... I had to expand it because it's not always showing the Pearl Harbor attack. It's also mentioning the attack or the effects of the attack. But you had Tora, Tora, Tora,
which was
the most obvious, okay, after the new CGI Pearl Harbor, okay, Jerry Bruckheimer's, you know, lavish film production. But then you do have, you know, quite a few films that mention the attack, or you have a scene where the people are sitting around the radio and they're hearing Franklin Delano Roosevelt saying, today, December 7th. So there, or films take off from the point where the attack happens. You know, was it the John Garfield movie, Air Force?
Sure.
Okay. But so there are lots of different films. I'd have to go back and do the other book to tell you exactly how many. But some of the things that have happened recently... one of the films that was shot in Hawaii that was a big budget production that was a disaster, a bomb at the time of its release, but now, in retrospect, maybe it was ahead of its time, which is Kevin Costner's Waterworld.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. At the time, it seemed like science fiction, but now, with global warming and the oceans rising, the waters... maybe it's not so science fiction anymore, and it's not as far-fetched.
Yeah.
So maybe in retrospect, that film needs to be looked at again, because quite possibly, I would say Costner and Kevin Reynolds were way ahead of their time in terms of the concern of that film.
I think people are starting to look at that film again and seeing that it's better than its reputation would have it. You know, a lot of times... a movie will just get the aura of being bad or a flop or whatever, and people just go to it with that in their mind, and that's what they see. So I think enough time has passed that people are looking at this and seeing this a little more interesting than they thought it was. So I don't know where they shot that, do you?
That was shot on the Big Island, in Hawaii. Yeah, it was totally shot in Hawaii.
All I can remember is water.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, well, they built this whole city out on a bay on the Big Island. They did do some exteriors later on, and they built some sets here at Universal. But for the most part, it was shot right off the coast of Hawaii.
Hmm.
Yeah, right, because you couldn't see land. So they had this platform that they would shoot, and they would move it with the sun in the day, you know.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So that was a big production. It was one of the most expensive films of its time.
Sure.
And again, it employed lots of local Hawaiian talent, mostly behind the camera and as extras. So it was a big boon to the Hawaiian film industry.
How much time do you spend in Hawaii?
I try to get there every couple of years. Okay, I have family in a small town called Hanapepe, which is in the island of Kauai. And so I try to get there at least every couple of years. And I love it there. It's the only place that I can really, truly feel relaxed.
Mm.
And I'm Puerto Rican from New York, and there's a Puerto Rican population in Hawaii that I wasn't aware of when I first went there, because Puerto Ricans went to Hawaii at the turn of the century because they had a labor shortage, and they needed agricultural workers to work in the sugarcane fields. And a group of Puerto Ricans went to Hawaii to work the sugarcane fields, and they stayed there. And there wasn't much difference from Puerto Rico to Hawaii in terms of the geography of the island.
Sure.
But they established a Puerto Rican presence in the island. So it kind of made me feel good when I first went to Hawaii when I was just out of college, that all the time I was in New York, nobody ever recognized, at that time, the Puerto Rican experience, either in a museum or anything.
Sure.
But when I went to Hawaii, of all places, I'm at the Bishop Museum, and in the little corner of the Bishop Museum is a little exhibit saying Puerto Rican contributions to the island. I'm going, oh my gosh. And, you know, that's how I learned about the whole Puerto Rican experience in Hawaii.
Wow.
You know? And then also, I also learned the Hawaiian word for cowboy is called paniolo, okay, which was a movie, original title for a movie with the late James Garner, which was about an American cowboy who goes to Hawaii and teaches the locals about cattle ranching, okay, because it was based on truth, but again, sort of the whitewashing, we call it, or in reality, it wasn't an American cowboy. It was Mexican vaqueros from California that were sent to Hawaii to teach the locals. That's why you get the word paniolo, because the Hawaiians called them Spanish, Español.
Yeah.
So that's where you get paniolo, Español. And the Mexicans also brought the guitar that became the ukulele later on. And you have the Spanish guitar in Hawaiian culture that became the ukulele later. There's a lot of history, you know.
Got a lot of ukuleles here, right?
Yeah, and the cattle was given given as a gift by some Englishmen to the king of Hawaii. Okay, because they had their own monarchy.
Wow.
They had a system of government, okay, that was taken over later by the English and then the Americans. Okay.
That sounds like an even better story. I would think that would make a better movie than the
yeah, but, you know, again, it's Hollywood, it's Disney. They always go for the easy thing. And, you know, again, you had James Garner play, and it's like he's not going to play Hispanic. He's going to play an American cowboy. So,
well, it's time for a remake is what I'm saying.
Oh, absolutely. Believe me, there's a... And then one of the most famous Hawaiians of the first part of the century was a gentleman by the name of Duke Kahanamoku, who's better known as the father of modern surfing.
Sure.
But he was an actor in Hollywood during the teens and the 30s. He's best known today for a movie he did with John Wayne called Wake of the Red Witch,
mm-hmm.
where he played the native chieftain. But he had done films in the silent era. But again, he was tall, he was dark, he was Polynesian. He played natives. Okay, he played every kind of native. He played in the, you know, Native American. He played, okay, but there was nowhere for him to go career-wise. He was very popular because he was an Olympic athlete. He won 4 championships. At one point, he was the fastest human in the water. Actually, he was defeated in the 32 Olympics by the future Tarzan, Johnny Weissmuller. So, anyway, but he was very well-known. He was Mr. Hawaii. He was... anybody that went to Hawaii, he was there. The most popular Hawaiian, best-known Hawaiian at the first part of the century until Don Ho came along.
Yeah.
You know, in the late 50s, early 60s.
Yeah, Duke shows up in a whole bunch of movies. It's really... I was reading about him not too long ago, and just one of those people who was never... never quite hit the stardom range where people would really know him as a movie star, but he was certainly a well-known supporting actor and very prolific, you know?
Oh, yeah, but at the time, again, what you talked about before is where's a African-American actor going to go? Where's an actor of color?
Sure.
Very limited opportunities. And for Duke, you saw him, you know, the real true Hawaiians are very dark-skinned, okay? The true Polynesian. They don't look like Dorothy L'Amour. I mean, it's interesting that a lot of the people that played Polynesians were Latinos, okay? You had Maria Montez, people like that, Rosenda Monteros, Dolores Del Rio. So it's interesting to note that, yeah, a lot of the people that did play in these the island girls were usually Latinas, except later on with Tarita,
mm-hmm.
Mutiny on the Bounty. She was actually Tahitian. And Jocelyn LeGrand in Hawaii, in the movie Hawaii, she actually won an Oscar for playing the queen, Malama. She had to be, she was like 350, 400 pound woman, but she was true Tahitian, and she won an Oscar nomination for Best Supporting Actress for that role in Hawaii.
Oh. And making Mutiny on the Bounty so impressed Marlon Brando that he just moved to Tahiti.
Oh, absolutely. He fell in love, he married one of the people, besides Tarita, he married a Hispanic actress that also played in Polynesian films. She was in Mutiny on the Bounty.
Mm-hmm.
Her name was Movita. And she didn't play Fletcher Christian's girlfriend. She played Leslie Howard's girlfriend.
Yeah.
Oh, no, not Leslie Howard. Fred Chotone.
Yeah.
Okay, girlfriend. She was Latina, Movita, and she played in Fort Apache. She played in lots of different films. But the other girl in it was Mamo Clark, and she was Hawaiian. And she played Fletcher Christian Clark Gable's girlfriend in Mutiny on the Bounty. And she was from Hawaii. I think Duke Kahanamoko's story would make a great movie. I mean, the three-time Olympic champion. I mean, the struggles that he faced in Hollywood and on the mainland, because he ran through a lot of prejudice. You know, they didn't know whether he was black or they didn't know what's a Hawaiian. They didn't. We're talking about 1912.
They couldn't figure out exactly how to hate him.
So. Yeah, exactly. So it was an interesting time for him. Also, when he first came to the mainland, in his first swim meet here, it was in Chicago. He had swam all of his life in Hawaii. So he goes to a pool in Chicago for the race, and he jumps in the pool and he freezes up because the water wasn't heated.
Wow.
Okay. Plus, he'd never experienced cold weather, so that was another issue. So, I mean, all of these things, and just interesting. Interesting that a lot of times the movies don't reflect the reality of what life is like. Even in Hawaii, I think The Descendants illustrates some of that. But it also falls into the South Seas genre, too.
Yeah.
But because it's really about a man who lives in the paradise, okay, who goes through an upheaval. He finds out that his wife has died in an accident, but she was having an affair. So his paradise is, and he has to go and find redemption somehow.
Yeah.
So it's still the same, but it does relate to life in Hawaii as it is today to a certain extent. The Sarah Marshall movie.
Again, yeah, Forgetting Sarah Marshall.
Yeah, it's the same thing, except that now it's not an island paradise. The island paradise in modern society today is a resort hotel.
Yeah.
Okay, and the island girl he falls for while trying to forget about his girlfriend is not really, she looks like an island girl, but she's originally from New Jersey or New York.
Yeah.
So the genre is still alive, but it's evolved and changed with the society and art, because basically most films reflect, you know, a lot of the concerns of the society today, you know, or when they were made.
Well, it's interesting that all the big motion pictures about Hawaii have tended to be about the past. and about an earlier society. And only when it came to the TV age and beyond did they start telling modern stories about Hawaii. But almost everything before that, like the movie Hawaii or any of those that we talked about, they're all about an earlier time.
Right.
And I wonder if that isn't trying to get us a step closer to true paradise without having to bring in urban neighborhoods and that sort of thing.
The earlier films dealt with an imaginary paradise that was based on literature of the past. And they took up a lot of those images and brought them to the forefront. But they even then, they wasn't the Hawaii, the true Hawaii. They just used an idyllic, made-up island paradise. It wasn't. It had elements of Hawaii, but it wasn't really Hawaii. There had elements of the culture, but it wasn't really. It brought in lots of different Polynesian, Melanesian cultural elements that were not. A lot of the Tahitian dancing that you see in a lot of Hawaiian films, that doesn't exist in Hawaii.
Well, sure.
The hip movements. I mean, Hawaiian dancing is more with the hands, okay? So there are a lot of different cultural things that were mixed up, like they do with the Old West or any other genre movie. It really is into modern times that you have more realistic portrayals of Hawaii. You still have a romanticized version of it, but it's more realistic to what Hawaii is today, even with Hawaiian Eye or Hawaii Five-O, the original one or the new version. There are elements of the culture that seep through with the different characters, the situations, the food that they eat. So there are elements of the culture that are brought in. Shave eyes, all of the Sai Min, all of these things that are the different foods that are eaten in Hawaii, the lunch, cultural things, King Kamehameha, lots of the cultural things that are part of Hawaii are brought in these television series because they deal with modern or contemporary Hawaii at the time. And you'll see that even today with the new Hawaii Five-O. Hawaii has always been part, since 1898, it's been part of the fabric of American culture. I mean, you have Hawaiian music, you have Hawaiian shirts, you know, Hawaiian Shirt Fridays. I mean, it's all part of the fabric of American culture. The pineapples, the Hawaiian punch, the tiki phase of the whole Polynesian pop restaurants. All of this has become it's the lexicon of Bukumdano. A lot of the urban kids relate to the police as 5-0. Here's 5-0. So it's become part of the culture, the fabric of America. And I think it's identified by people all around the world, you know, because of the power of movies and television. I mean, people actually would call Hawaii to find out about Hawaii 5-0 to help them on a case. Another country's police department called Hawaii because they needed help from Hawaii 5-0 on a case, and HPD, the Honolulu Police Department, had to tell them, listen, it's a fictional show. There's no state police in Hawaii. Every island has their own police. Okay? So, but people believed that there was a McGarrett and that it actually existed. So it's the power of film, the power of cinema, communications, and it's just a wonderful thing, and that we're able to share that. And then those of us who are fortunate enough and now are able to go to Hawaii and see the real thing. And that's one of the nice things about my book, is I was able to put the locations.
Yeah.
So that the locations that still exist are still there. People can go see where they filmed Donovan's Reef on Kauai, or Raiders of the Lost Ark, or go to Schofield Barracks to see where they filmed From Here to Eternity, you know, or Iolani Palace, and you'll discover that McGarrett's office is tiny.
Well, next time I go to Hawaii, I'm definitely taking that book, because that's the sort of stuff I love to do. I love location hunting, and you're making it easy for me on some of these things, so that'll be great. Now, are you working on anything else now?
Yes. I'm right now presently working, getting towards the tail end of a book. Like I said, I was trying to do a niche for myself. So I'm doing a book called Echo in Mexico, which translates to Made in Mexico, which is about Hollywood's films made in Mexico that deal with Mexico or not with Mexico, but that were actually filmed there. A lot of people don't know Titanic was filmed in Mexico.
Absolutely. Rosarito Beach.
That's right. Master and Commander, okay, with Russell Crowe. But then you can go back to Viva Villa with Wallace Beery was filmed in Mexico. Falcon and the Snowman, you know, John Schlesinger film.
Yeah.
So there's quite a bit of Elysium, okay, most recently. Vantage Point. There's so many films that have been shot there over the years that have used Mexico as a location or as somewhere else, as John Wayne shot seven of his films in Mexico, particularly in Durango, Mexico. So there's a lot of film history and also deals with the relationships between the United States and Mexico and also how these films influenced the filmmakers.
Yeah.
Because people like John Ford were one of the first ones to go to Mexico, and they used a lot of Mexican talent because at that time Mexico was in the midst of its own golden age of film, and people like Gabriel Figueroa, who's a master cinematographer, worked for John Ford, but he also worked for John Huston.
Yeah.
Okay, one of the first films to shoot after the war, again, the same thing because of mobility and transport, was Treasure of the Sierra Madre. Okay, and that's where we had discovered Alfonso Bedoya. Okay, and John Ford employ him was Pedro Armendariz.
Yeah.
Was a leading man in many Mexican films, and today probably is best known for Fort Apache or for the James Bond film, which he did just before he died.
Or Three Godfathers,
From Russia with Love. Yeah.
Claire and I were at a film festival in Spain about 20 years ago in San Sebastian, Spain. They had republished my book on Wellman, and they were doing a sub-series on Wellman's films while we were there. There was this incredible opera house, and when you were the guests of the film festival, as we were, you would walk in, they would announce your name, there's this huge staircase, and there were costumed Basque people on either side of the thing, and half of them had swords and half of them had paddles. I never found out what that was for, but they crossed it over your head as you walked up. We were waiting. We were the next people. We were going to be announced to go up. You went up one couple at a time. And a man came up and he said, "I don't want to bother you, but I'm in a hurry to get up there. Do you mind if I walk up with you when they call your name?" And we said, "Of course, come in." So we walk up and I said, "My name is Frank and this is Claire." And he said, "Oh, I'm Armendariz." And I said, and so we get up to the front, get up to the top. I said, "Wait a minute, you're Pedro Armendariz?" And he said, "Yeah." And it was Pedro Armendariz Jr. And so I said, "Wow, let's talk." So we brought him into our box set and sat there for about an hour and just talked with him about his dad and about the movies. Of course, he's been in a million movies himself and played Pancho Villa in one, at least one.
Old Gringo.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was quite a little bit of serendipity there for us.
and he had the I had talked to him also, and he had the advantage. He went with his dad to the sets of Fort Apache, so he knew Ford. He was on the sets for a lot of the films that his dad did. So it was interesting talk to him, and he said, "Oh, but do I have a?" I remember him telling me, and then I was never able to get it from him. But he said he had a. He says, "You want to know about photos?" He says, "I got a photo of me as a baby, okay, sitting on a table, and behind me, all drunk, are John Wayne, my father, Robert Mitchell, you know, all in Mexico, just having a great time, and I'm just a little baby there on the table." Now that's a picture.
That is a picture. I'd like to meet him again. Is he still alive?
No, he died.
Oh, shoot.
He died about a year ago.
Oh,
unfortunately,
man.
He died of cancer, you know, so unfortunately. But great, great man. Great.
Yeah, because that was 21 years ago that we were in Spain for that thing. So luckily, they invited us when we were both 3 years old. So it was so it worked out fine. Luis, I can't tell you how much fun I've had talking to you. It's really, I've wanted to have you on the show for a long time. So I'm going to put links to your books on the website. So when people go to listen to the podcast, they'll see Amazon links to your books. And so everybody will order them, and you'll sell them, and I'll get a little bit of a kickback from Amazon, and Amazon will be happy, and the whole world will work.
All right. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate being here, and I appreciate being able to speak with you and your listeners, that people that really are interested in movies and love movies and want to learn about movies and all kinds of movies.
It's been great. I hope we can do it again one of these days.
Absolutely. When I finish the Hecho in Mexico, Made in Mexico, we'll get back and we can talk about all the movies that were shot in Mexico.
Count on it, because I would love to talk about that. So you will be back. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Aloha and mahalo.
That was fun talking with Luis. We had a great time, although I felt really bad. It was a hot, hot, hot day. And even though we left the air conditioning on in the house, the door to my tiny little office, which I sometimes use as a studio, had to be closed, had to turn off the overhead fan, and it did get pretty sweltering in here, and I think Luis was about to pass out toward the end of it. But he didn't sound like it, so it was, I just felt guilty about it. I hope he's feeling better. Hope he's up and around. And while I'm hoping, I hope that you'll go to my websites, thecommentarytrack.com and frankthompson.tv. There will be links to Luis's books, all three of them. And I hope that you'll go through my link on either website and bookmark it, if you would. That would be great. Clear your cookies would be even better. But bookmark it, get through on my website, order those books, or order anything you like. Order my books, order DVDs from other guests, or books from other guests, or buy anything. Buy a couch, or even, if you can't afford a couch, buy an ottoman. Just buy something that's stuffed. And then I'll get a little bit of a something-something from Amazon, and that's sweet. I want to thank my wonderful wife, Claire McCullough, for being my announcer on both this and on Radio Movies, my other podcast, in which I play classic radio shows of the 30s and 40s, which are based on classic movies, and I try to give a good, solid, in-depth film history introduction to them. That's been going over pretty well with the people who get in touch with me and let me know that they like it. And coming up this week is Red River, the Howard Hawks classic, with three stars of the movie, John Wayne, Joanne Drew, and the great Walter Brennan. So that'll drop on Thursday. It'll be available on Thursday. It'll drop Wednesday night. And I hope that you'll take a listen to that. So, got another great one coming up next week. And in the meantime, don't you worry. We'll fix it in post.